The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. I, for the next hour, I shall read you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And let's start off with the drama in real life. The teacher who wrestled a cougar. When a wildcat springs from the woods to prey on her young students, a daycare owner instantly moves to protect them. A classic Reader's Digest drama. Nudged awake by the morning sun, the young cougar opened its jaws in a teeth-bearing yawn and stretched its muscular forelegs. Then it started down the mountainside, crossed a narrow highway, and loped into the wide, rushing river. For days, the cougar had been edging closer to the small lumber village of Lilibet on the Fraser River at the edge of the mountains in southern British Columbia and Canada. Now, after drinking the river's cold water, the cougar bedded down again in a nest of tall grass. On 3 July 1991, the five children in Lorraine Leach's daycare group were outdoors early, painting bright tempera landscapes under the penetrating sun. By 10 a.m., it was time to find shade, so Lorraine decided they would walk down to the river. "We're going to pick berries now," she announced. At 44, she had made her dream come true when she turned her home into a daycare center. It had taken hard work to get her certification. After completing her courses in early childhood education, Lorraine had volunteered in a daycare center while working at a lumber mill and raising three teen sons alone. So far, the center was operating smoothly, but she always worried about keeping her clients satisfied as well as being able to care for enough children to make the business pay off. Lorraine had known all five children in her care since they were infants. Three were siblings, playful Mikey, age 2, 3.5-year-old Alicia, and tough little athlete, and Jessica Allen, 5. The exuberant leader, 4-year-old Natalie Leach, was actually an aunt to the three siblings, and Lorraine, in turn, was Natani's aunt. Only the bubbly toddler, Lisa O'Lady, a few months shy of 2, was unrelated to them. All were members of the indigenous tribes clustered around Lilliloot, around 150 miles northeast of Vancouver. The children had fallen easily into Lorraine's daily routine. Everyone loved circle time when they passed around a black and white eagle feather. Child who held it could talk about whatever he or she wanted. A nature lover, Lorraine also insisted they spend as much time as possible outdoors. After clearing away the painting supplies and handing each child an empty jar on that July morning, Lorraine called for Pal, her 1-year-old German Shepherd mix. Giggling with anticipation, Jessica and Natani paired off in front. Lorraine licked Mikey's hand with Alicia's, took little Lisa's in her own, and said, "Let's go." Lorraine's house stood on a wooded slope not far up from the mighty Fraser River. The group made its way over the dusty gravel road and into the dirt trail through the trees. The two oldest girls broke into a run through the tall brown grass at the trail's edge. Natani's wasting hair swaying back and forth, Lorraine and the little ones hurried to keep up. Stopping the children at the first berry bush, Lorraine pointed to the clusters of plump, sweet, navy blue fruit. "Look, the berries are all over," she said. She helped Lisa find some clusters on the lowest branches, and Mikey watched them intently bit into a berry. "Oom, good," he said, and got busy plucking more. The cougar cocked an ear toward the bird-like chatter and reflexively sniffed the air. Cougars rarely attack people or show themselves, but as town expanded into the mountainous countryside, there had been more and more sightings, especially in the southern British Columbia. At the time, the province was home to some 3,000 of them. The young cougar was instinctively versed in hunting strategies. Step sidling and downwind through the brush to avoid being heard, scented, or seen. Choose the weakest prey and attack from behind, clamping powerful jaws on the vital nerves and blood vessels of the prey's neck. Lorraine and the children moved slowly from bush to bush. Pal stopped frequently in the shade, panting. Within 20 minutes, the children had filled their jars and were almost at the river. Here the ground fell sleepy to a cool, shady strip of sand, roughly 15 feet wide. "Okay," Lorraine commanded after the group clambered down to the sandbank. "Let's get in a circle." She could not risk letting a child wander off. Suddenly, Alicia jumped up and scooted toward the trees. "Come back, Alicia," Lorraine called. Running after her, she caught up with the child and helped her back to the sandbank. Now they could see the funny little creatures that had been making all the noise. They were perfect prey, small, wiggly, and oblivious. Stepping over the thick carpet of pine needles, the cat slunk toward the children, never so much as rustling a leaf or snapping a twig. Then it did something remarkable, something only a young, inexperienced cat would do. It walked onto the bank and merely nudged Mikey backward onto the sand. The rules of hunting required that a cougar grab the boy's head in his mouth and carry him away. But the young cat paused, and to remove any hair before attacking if eating, It began to lick the boy's smooth skin with its rough tongue. The rain sensed the children suddenly go quiet. She looked up to see the back end of a cat the size of Pal standing over Mikey. The cat's head was down, out of sight behind his peaked shoulder blades, and its plump back-tipped tail swiped back and forth like a whip. The sight of the cougar near her kids momentarily froze Lorraine. Now Nantani was giggling nervously. "Stop licking Mikey's face," she said playfully, as if talking to a house cat. Lorraine couldn't tell where Mikey had been bitten. He was silent and hidden beneath the beast. Her mind racing mildly, she sprang impulsively toward the cougar. Blindly intending to grab its tail, she shifted aim at the last minute and seized the cat by the scruff of its neck. Tugging once, she shook it side by side. Instantly, the cougar unsheathed its claws and wheeled toward Lorraine, swiping both Mikey and Lisa in the face. Growling and hissing, it stretched up high and brought its paws down upon the head of the 5-foot-1-inch woman. As she stumbled backward, one paw slipped into her right shoulder, the claws grazing her ear. The cannibal was capable of killing her. Though still in its youth, it had all the teeth and muscle Kamuru needs to pull down a victim 3 times its size. Aware now of the danger, 4 of the children shrieked and ran behind Lorraine. Mikey lay still on the ground. "Stay behind me," Lorraine screamed as she faced the beast. Acting before she could think, she grabbed the animal's forelegs and pulled them off her. The cougar's thrashing forced her back into a crouch. Her soft sandals shifted and slipped into stand, making it difficult to keep a secure stance. Summoning all her strength, Lorraine forced herself back upright, still grabbing the cat's thick legs. Then she thrust her arms forward and locked them straight out in front of her. At the same time, she used her thumbs to push the animal's paws inward to restrict herself from being cut. Locked in a deadly dance with the cougar, Lorraine felt as though she were watching herself in slow motion. She stared at the animal's pink tongue and long ivory fangs. Stepping back and forth on its hind legs, the cat let out a menacing growl as it tried to tug its paws, with her sharp claws, away from her. "Pal, do something," she yelled at the dog, cowering on the sand not 10 feet away. She felt the muscles in her arms and legs and back weakening. "What am I going to do?" she thought. "If the cat gets away from me, he'll kill the children." "Just go away and leave us alone," she yelled at the animal's face. "Leave us alone." The cougar was now trying a new tactic to break Lorraine's grip. It began thrashing its upper body from side to side, and Lorraine could sense its imminent escape. Again acting without any conscious plan, she arched her back to gather momentum, then shoved forward with all her might, thrusting crackly directly at the dog. "Pal, do something." The cougar fell backward, but rolled instantly to its feet and darted past Pal through the brush farther along the sandbank. Without knowing it, Lorraine had responded perfectly. She had distracted the cougar from Mikey only a fraction of a second before it had a chance to crush the boy's skull with its mighty jaws. Then her aggressive movements and loud shouting probably scared the animal. Cougars experts say that cats often lose their appetite for killing when angrily confronted. Watching the cat retreat, Pal gave a chase, barking madly. In one bound, the cougar leaped halfway up a pine tree, then climbed to the top, wrapped its paws around a branch and hung there, looking down at the dog. Lorraine raced to Mikey, who lay quiet in the sand. The left side of his face and neck was bathed in blood, but he was breathing, and his eyes were open so wide they seemed to bulge from his face. "He's alive," Lorraine thought, gasping relief, but he was eerily still. He must be in shock, she decided. She pulled him into her arms. Then her eyes fell on Lisa, wailing at her side. The girl's face was also covered with blood. Shifting Mikey to her right side and scooping Lisa up her left arm, Lorraine called to the other children. "We have to run home now." She saw their terror as they looked at her. She touched her face and felt blood dripping. "It's scarier than just to look at me," she realized. "Let's go," she ordered, "as fast as we can." They scrambled up the hill, and Lisa still crying. Mikey remained silent. Lorraine soon found the 2 children too heavy to carry and eased Mikey down. He suddenly jolted from his stupor. "Owie, owie, owie," he screamed, tears coursing down his face. Lorraine pulled him along toward the house. Pal lingered behind, watching the cougar before finally following the others. "Everything should be all right," Lorraine called out to the kids, but deep down she was not so certain. The cougar could be anywhere. She considered what had already done to Lisa, to Mikey, and to the dream she had worked so long to realize. Would any parents trust her with their children after this? In 5 minutes they were all inside the front door. Suddenly Lorraine was aware of her own pain. Her thighs were bruised, the scratches on her arm, forehead, and ear burned. Her hand shook as she telephoned the hospital and the parents of Lisa and Mikey. At the little hospital, Mikey needed 40 stitches to close lacerations on his chin and neck, but all his wounds were shallow. Lisa had been lucky, too. The cat had clawed with an inch of her right eye, and she required only 20 stitches. Lorraine's scratches needed only to be cleaned and left to heal, but the muscles in her arms, back, and legs were so sore that she had difficulty walking. As awful as the attack was, Lorraine now had to contend with the fact that she had no idea whether her beloved daycare center could remain open. She felt a sense of profound relief the morning after the attack when she opened the front door to four of her daycare children, including Mikey. Only Lisa did not return. For several days, as they sat in a circle passing the eagle feather, the children remained quiet. The picture that painted our time was showing was splattered with red. Finally, a week later, Mikey took the eagle feather in his hand and said, "I had a dream last night." "And what did you see in your dream?" Lorraine asked gently. "I saw an eagle, and he was sitting on my bed. Then he flew over me." Lorraine smiled. In Lilouette folklore, the eagle is a sign of strength sent by ancestors as an assurance that the person who sees it will be kept safe. She knew the child was beginning to feel secure again. Lorraine felt secure, too. She had only gotten word about the cougar 9 days after the attack. It had wandered in her neighbor's yard and was put down. But above and beyond her regained sense of safety, Lorraine had met the greatest challenge of her life head-on and won. Her friends and neighbors applauded her strength. As a result, Lorraine knew that she could accomplish anything. In 1992, Canada's Governor General honored Lorraine's bravery by awarding her the Star of Courage. She died in 2020 at age 73, and there's a picture of her. She's a very attractive woman. And let us go to a first-person report. The dogs who taught me about love. And there's paintings here of six different dogs: Playboy, Matt the Mutt, Lucy, Indigo, Brown, and Sausage. They weren't all nice. In fact, some of them were beasts. But each one showed what it means to care for someone without reservation. After we lost Indigo, I got a call from the Bed and Biscuit. One of their customers was dying, and her dog, Chloe, needed a home. Given our recent loss, they asked, might our family be interested in adopting her? They had to be kidding. After Indigo, we would never get another dog, ever. Indigo. It had just been a few years earlier, it seemed, that an Indigo, a black lab, had first barged through our door. Her underbelly showed the signs of the litter she'd recently delivered, and between the wise, droopy face and the swinging dog teeth, she was a sight to behold. She had a nose for trouble. On one occasion, I came home to find that she'd eaten a 5-pound bag of flour. She was covered in white powder, and flower paw prints were everywhere, included incredibly on the countertop. I asked the dog what the hell had happened, and then he just looked at me with a glance and said, "I cannot imagine to what you are referring." Time raced by. Our children grew up and went off to college. The mirror, which had reflected a young mom an Indigo first arrived, now showed a woman in late middle age. I had surgery for cataracts. I began to lose my hearing. We all turned gray, me, my spouse, the dog. In August 2017, I took Indigo for one last walk. She was slow and unsteady on her paws. She looked up at me mournfully. "You did say you'd take care of me when the time came," she said. "You promised, Jenny." She died that month, a tennis ball by her side. I told the Bed and Biscuit we were sorry, but wouldn't be adopting any more dogs. I'd owned a succession of dogs since 1964. Each one of them a witness to a particular phase of my life. But with the loss of Indigo, all that was over. The days of my dogs, I now understood, were done at last. Then one morning, as I was passing the Bed and Biscuit in my car, I pulled over. I could at least lay my eyes upon this Chloe. What harm could it do? She had a soft face. When Chloe entered her house, she was cautious, uncertain. She spent hours that first day going to every corner sniffing things out. Finally, she sat down by the fireplace and gave me a look. "If you wanted," she said, "I would stay with you." Playboy. Everything I know about love I've learned from dogs, but everything I know about loss I've learned from them, too. They fill our hearts. They leave flowery paw prints all over the house. They lick the tears from our faces, and then in what seems like no time at all, they're gone. It reminds me a little bit of what people say about childbirth. If you really remember how difficult it was, you never go through it more than once. And yet, year after year, dog after dog, I forgot the grief of losing them, right up until the moment that they give me that look with their gray faces. "Jenny, you promised." The pain of their loss doesn't seem to be lessened one bit by the fact that many of the dogs I've owned have been kind of terrible. My first dog, for instance, was a bad-tempered Malmaison named Playboy, a resentful hoodlum who loved no one but my father. We lived in the far country of eastern Pennsylvania then, and Playboy had no qualms about chasing donkeys, cows, and even on one occasion, a leather-jacketed Hell's Angel racing by on a Harley. That dog once stole the Thanksgiving turkey right off the table. He bit people. There were times when my sister and I hated this guts. We were fairly sure the feeling was mutual. And yet he was devoted to my father, a soft-spoken man who had always wanted to be a medieval history professor, but who wound up working at a bank instead. At the end of the day, Dad would come through the door with the evening bulletin, tug off his tie, and often with an air of grim exhaustion. Then he'd sit down in a leather chair, and Playboy would lie down on his side and roll around until the paws were in the air, and my father would rub the dog's belly. "Who's a good boy?" he'd ask. "Who's a good boy?" It was a good question. What I did learn about love from Playboy, that it's perfectly fine if everyone hates you as long as you're deeply loved by one person. Sausage. In adolescence, I had another Dalmatian, a sad, overweight blob named Sausage. I got her for my 11th birthday, and for several years I adored her, carrying that dog around like a Raggedy Ann doll. Some nights she slept in my bed, her head upon the pillow next to mine. "I'd always love you," I told the dog. "We'll always be best friends." But the promise I made as a child was hard to keep once I became a surly teenager, and Sausage developed some obscure condition that caused her to lose the hair on her tail, and silly brown goos eased out of her eyes. Friends coming over to my house made fun of Sausage. They said my dog was gross, and unless they were not wrong. More unforgivably, though, my dog was uncool, a reminder of the nerd I myself had bought in so long ago. And so I turned my back on her. I made other friends, some of them boys who owned hot rods with T-tops. It was from Sausage that I learned this awful truth. Sometimes love fades as you age. It can be hard to keep a promise you made when you were young. Matt the Mutt. At the end of her freshman year at Carleton, my sister brought home a terrible dog named Matt the Mutt, who had been raised in her dormitory. She handed over to my parents. "He's yours," and headed west. Just like that, the reign of Matt the Mutt began. For the next 8 years, the dog bounced around the house, lifting his leg pretty much wherever he pleased, knocking people over, barking incessantly. Anyone come through the door, including my tired father with his briefcase and his newspaper, would be instantly assailed by the bouncing, howling creature. Matt the Mutt was a love machine, a regular Pepe Le Pew. He would copulate pretty much anything. Ottomans, the mailbox, even the now geriatric Sausage. Above all, he lived to make love to my grandmother's leg, which was fine, I guess. My grandmother thought it was funny. "He's got more punk than your grandpa," said she. From Matt the Mutt, I learned this. Sometimes the happiest people are the ones that make everyone else's life impossible. Brown. When I was in my 20s, my parents got a lab named Brown. This time we swore just once we'd owned a dog that was not completely insane. In this, our hopes proved nugatory. Brown developed a strange addiction to running water. She would move a kitchen chair to the sink with her snout and open the tap with her teeth. Then she'd stand on the chair biting the running water. Later, the dog became obsessed with chewing her own paws, something the vet describes as lick granuloma, sort of making her constantly wear one of those cones of shame. Nothing could compel Brown to stop the chewing. The dog ate her own feet as if they were a delicacy rarer than a clam's casino. They were tasty, I guess. We'd hoped that this time we'd have a normal dog. But from Brown I learned, instead, of that sometimes people who seem the most normal turn out to be the craziest. Still, it was Brown that provided me with consolation. My father died of melanoma. As I sat in a chair in my mother's house weeping, the dog came over and put her head in my lap. "Do not be dismayed, for I am thy dog," she said. "Whoever lives in love lives in dog, and dog in him." Brown looked at me with steadfastness and adoration, and her tail thumped against the floor. There had been scars on her legs. Maybe with time they could be healed. Lucy. I got married just after I turned 30, and we moved to a farmhouse in central Maine where I got a job teaching English at Colby College. There we were joined by a yellow dog I bought from a pig farmer. We called Lucy a Kennebec Valley flycatcher on account of a fondness for biting flies right out of the air. Sometimes she'd look at me as if to say, "They might be flies to you, but to me they are sky raisins." Lucy would give me other looks, usually in shades of disdain. When my daughter was in third grade, she wrote an essay for school. "Our dog hates us." It was true, too. Everything about our family seemed to annoy Lucy. For a while, this made me feel a little puny, until at last I realized that Lucy was just lonesome for the place she had lived first, our neighbor's pigsty. And so from Lucy I learned this. Sometimes all people want this thing they had when they were young. Each of these dogs had taught me something about the perilous nature of devotion. Some people will tell you that the magic of dogs is their love for us is unconditional. But I've never found this to be the case. What's unconditional is the love that we have for them. At 60, I'm pretty sure that there is any reason why we're here on this planet. It is in order to love one another. It is, as the saying goes, all you know on earth, all you need to know. Yet, as it turns out, nothing is harder than loving human beings. That's where dogs come in. It's in our love for dogs that we can most express how hard it is to be human, how glorious and how sad. I remember my father, exhausted from his job, asking our terrible Dalmatian, "Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy?" It occurs to me now that in asking this, what he was really saying was, "I am, Playboy. I am." Chloe. After Chloe joined us, I had hopes of having a conversation with her previous owner, the woman who had been laid low by cancer. I wanted her to know that her dog had found a good home and that we'd take care of her. When I finally got through, though, I learned that Colonel Cyrus had died the week before. It snowed that night, and I woke up in a room made mysterious by light and stillness. In the morning, I sat up and found that Chloe had climbed into bed with us as we slept. "Well," she asked. I tossed her soft ears in the bright, quiet room and thought about the gift of grace. "If you wanted," I said, "I would stay with you, too." The weight of the world. Quarantine expanded so many waistlines. Time for revenge. See how these COVID area terms feel with a little extra padding on them. COVID-30, formerly COVID-15, the amount of weight gained by an average adult during quarantine, sometime related to a pandemic. Pandemic, a potentially dangerous increase in the baking of bread in quarantine home. Flattening the curve, trying to fit in your jeans after months of sweatpants. See COVID-30. How about some everyday heroes now? And there's a picture of a young man. He's got a shaved head. He's a good-looking young man. Got his arms crossed. He's kneeling on one leg. Dr. Quan A. Stewart drives around town seeking out potential vet patients to help. The street vet. A California veterinarian makes house calls to pet owners who have no place to call home. Quan A. Stewart stepped inside a Modesto, California convenience store with his morning coffee and spotted a homeless man sitting with his back against a building. It was 2011, and the Great Recession had spilled a lot of unfortunate people onto the streets. A small dog sat in the homeless man's lap. Stewart, a veterinarian and animal shelter, noticed his scratched-off fur and chewed-up skin, telltale signs of an allergic reaction to fleas. He approached the man and offered to bring flea medication for the dog again, a gift the man readily accepted. "I remember it occurring a week and a half later, and the hair was coming back and the rash was gone," Stewart told the Modesto Bee. The man said his dog was finally sleeping at night again because it was no longer staying up scratching and chewing. "And you know," he said, "I'm sleeping at night," he started to cry. "And that got me choked up too," Stewart says. Stewart was hooked. "When you get bed back, there is something you get in return that feels so much larger. I knew I wanted to keep doing it," he told Medium.com. Today, Stewart, 50, has his own practice in town. Yet he still finds time for street pets. He's helped roughly 400 animals since 2011, mostly dogs, but also a few cats, and once a Burmese python. There's a dire need for this kind of help. About 25% of Modesto's homeless population own a pet, but there are few health care options available to them. To fill that void, Stewart can often be found wandering Doc Ardwell's and underpasses, anywhere as he thinks the homeless might be camped out. He carries his medical bag, which contains treatments, vaccines, antibiotics, and anti-inflammatories, flea medications, and more, for most of the cases he encounters. Stewart pays almost all of it out of his pocket. "Their animals are the reasons for getting up in the morning," he says. And there's a picture of a young man, kind of ratty looking, unfortunately, and he's got a little brown dog. Dr. Stewart says of his homeless clients, "I've gotten a lot more from them than I feel like they've gotten from me. Occasionally he comes upon a medical problem that requires more attention than he can provide on the street. For those expensive procedures, he set up a GoFundMe account to help cover treatment costs. I don't ever want to have to turn anybody away," he explains. He knows there are some people who question whether the homeless should even have pets. "How can they care for them on the street? I think more than anybody, they need a pet. They deserve a pet," Stewart told the Bee. "They love their pet probably more than the average person because, you know, the owner is the pet's home." There's one more pressing reason for the homeless to have pets. "I can't tell you how many times people have told me their animals are the reason for getting up in the morning," Stewart says. One of these people is Joe, an articulate, white-haired, middle-aged man who has landed on rough times. He says his black-and-white mixed breed is his life. When I first hit the streets, I was almost to the point where I'd given up, he said in a video that Stewart posted on a GoFundMe page. This dog was an answer to my prayers. Every morning I wake up, her tail is wagging. She's always giddy. I don't feel that loneliness. If something happened to her, I don't know what I'd do. To have somebody like Dr. Stewart come at her to take care of my dog just because it's the right thing to do, that's so huge. And then there's a picture of a lady, looks like she's probably in her mid-50s or maybe early 60s, and it says, giving the gifts on her birthday. Deborah Farrell got the standard well wishes on Facebook on her 53rd birthday, but she got some unusual messages too. One was about a family in Minnesota who had just lost their 4-year-old son to cancer. His older brother, autistic and nonverbal, was especially grief-stricken. Could Farrell help? That message and the 30 others like it were exactly what Farrell was looking for. To celebrate her 53rd, the long-term social service professional and certified sweetie had put out a call on her Facebook page. She wanted to commit 53 random acts of kindness by the end of her birth month, and she needed information on people who could use one. When she got the note about the Minnesota family, she sent a wind chime with the message. Listen to the wind and know that I am nearer, inscribed on the clapper, and now hangs in the 4-year-old's bedroom, where his brother can go to listen to it whenever he wants. This is not the first time that Farrell decided to give gifts for her birthday. For her 47th in 2014, she founded Love with Skin On, an organization dedicated to doing good deeds in her home in Roanoke, Virginia, and beyond. Its motto is simple, be love, do stuff. Over the years, Farrell has reached out and touched well over 100 strangers. Someone found Facebook call-outs, other with help from her grandkids. In another act of giving, she shares her favorite inexpensive creative gift ideas on Pinterest for others to use. Farrell pays for everything herself, gift cards, pay-it-forward purchases at drive-thrus, and care packages, as well as the gas it takes to play fairy godmother. Her family often gives her some extra birthday cash with a stern warning not to spend it on anything else, which she naturally ignores. I got a couple of Amazon gift cards for her birthday this year, and it was like, yes, it's Farrell's party, and she'll give if she wants to. And now we switch over to Consumer Reports. What we're testing in our labs. In our 63 labs, we continue to review and rate products. Here are timely picks for this month. Power pressure washers. They tested 33 models and tested for power, efficiency, and versatility when cleaning a range of surfaces, including outdoor furniture, decking, and concrete walkways. Median score was 62, the range was 45 to 71, and the best model is the Simpson SM673, $330. Best electric model was the Greenwooks GPW2700 at $350, and the Great Electric for Less is the Sunjo SPX3000, $160. Cast iron frying pans. We tested 23 encoded and uncoated pans. We tested how evenly the skillet heats up and how well a model can bake cornbread and sear a strip steak, plus how easy it is to clean. The median score was 70, and the range was 51 to 83. And the top uncoated skillet was the Butter Pat Joan for $295, 83. $295 for a skillet? Jeez. Top enamel coated skillet. Tramatona 80-131 for $70, scored 80. Uncoated bargain. Artisanal Kitchen Supply Pre-Seasons Bed and Bath Beyond for $25, 77 score. What's the difference between enamel-coated and uncoated cast iron pans? A cast iron pan with enamel coating doesn't need to be seasoned with vegetable oil to prevent rusting, while an uncoated cast iron pan does, says CR tester Tara Casagoela. Plus, the smoother enamel surface is easier to clean. But beware that enamel-coated pans can't be used on a campfire and can chip over time if dropped or hit with a heavy utensil. Replace a chip pan to be sure no bits of enamel get in your food. Both types retain heat well enough to sear steaks, brown scallops, and break cornbread. But in fact, every cast iron pan we tested, coated or uncoated, aced our searing test, though the pricey Butter Pat Jonah pan above turns out the best cornbread. Window air conditioners. I tested 21 models, how quickly a window unit can cool a room, how accurate it cools and set a temperature, and how noisy it is during use and more. Median score was 73. The range was 52 to 87. Top rated for medium-sized rooms, the Madea U-shaped MAW8, $360, and it scored the max score, 87. Smart pick for small rooms, the Frigidaire FREE 063 at $270, scored a 75. Cool choice for large rooms, 350 to 650 square feet. Whirlpool WHAW 101, $340, scored a 74. Gaming laptops. We tested 90 models for performance while running applications and 3D games, quality of display, ergonomics, battery life, and more. All the tested laptops, the median 66, range 21 to 87. Highest score they're showing here is a 72. Powerful performance but short battery life, MSI GC75 Raider for $1,350. Speedy and long life battery life, the Asus ROG Zephyrus, $1,500. And great value for gaming, 16. At $900, HP Pavilion, 69. Blood pressure monitors. We tested 28 bottles, and we tested for accuracy of readings, comfort while using, and more. The arm, about the scores for arm, 77, median was 77, range was 55 to 86. For the wrist, the median was 59, range was 19 to 79. Rated overall, the Omerol Platinum BP5450 from Amazon, $81, 86 overall score. Super accurate bargain, the iHealth KN55OBT at $40, got a 78 overall score. And good portable wrist model, Equate at Walmart, Series BPK3KC3EWM at $40, it scored an 78. We tested 18 models, picture quality of streaming video and how easy it is to set up and use every day, and also how user-friendly the interface is for tasks like navigating menus. Median score was 65, range was 46 to 76. Top quality 5 features, NVIDIA Shield TV Pro at $200, 76. Nice price plus headphones, the Roku Ultra at $20, $95, and scored a 73. And the great for Alexa uses the Amazon Fire Cube at $120, scored a 70. My AC isn't cooling well, and it's the busy season for repairs. Can I troubleshoot it myself? This is the expert. Ask the expert section. Excuse my tongue twisting there. For some reason, it's getting turned around all the time. Absolutely. We ask air conditioner pros and CR test engineer to identify the most common problems that crop up with window and central air conditioners and what consumers can do about them. The most common problem, a dirty filter, affects the performance of window units and central AC systems, and you can clean or replace the filters yourself. A clogged filter restricts airflow, reducing the ability to cool air. For central AC systems, check the manual for when to swap in a new filter, and CR's test filters last anywhere from 3 to 12 months. If you have pets whose fur can clog filters more quickly, or your system is running constantly, you need to change the filters more often. Vacuum the vents where the air circles in and out, and check the outdoor compressor to make sure the area around it is clear. For adequate airflow, the compressor needs at least 2 feet of space between it and any plants or objects, and 5 feet between the top of the unit and any tree branches above. Window units typically have a reusable filter that you can clean with a quick vacuum or heavy debris before washing it with soap and water. Then check the seals where the unit meets the window. Most new window units come with insulation panels to cover place over the plastic adjustable side panels, says senior CR tester Chris Reagan. But to maximize efficiency, use weather stripping around the unit. If none of those moves work, compare it to the cost of a repair visit with a new window unit. If your air conditioner is more than 8 years old, it's probably time to replace it. I haven't used my car in months. What should I do before heading the road? Cars are designed to move. When they sit still, parts can become rusted, batteries drain, and critters can move in, says John Ibbotson, CR's chief mechanic. He advises inspecting a few things yourself, but adds, if your first trip is going to be a long one, have it serviced by a pro. To start, check the tire pressure. The proper inflation level is on a sticker in the driver's door jamb. Look under the hood, inspecting hoses and belts for cracks and leaks. Scan for rodent damage, such as chew marks, included inside the air filter box. If the oil hasn't been changed for 6 months or longer, have it replaced. Check the car battery and clean off any corrosion around the terminals. If the car is slow to start, use a trickle charger to replenish the battery. For a car that won't start, AAA members can request a jump start or battery replacement. Once you move the car, look at the parking space for signs of a leak. On the road, watch for any warning lights, or if your brakes are noisy, it's probably just rust That will polish off after a few drives. The brakes are sticky or responsive, though. Have a mechanic look at them. Can I use my smartwatch to check my blood pressure? The CR has not yet tested smartwatches and fitness trackers for accuracy of this feature. We reviewed the medical literature on them and spoke with independent experts who told us that these technologies used by the devices might not match the accuracy of a more traditional home monitor, especially one that uses a cup on the upper arm. The traditional monitor pressures blood pressure by sensing the pressure exerted by blood on an artery. That's what's happening when the cuff tightens and then relaxes around your arm, says CR tester Susan Booth. Smartwatches or fitness trackers, on the other hand, gather other data from your body through an optical sensor placed against your skin that emits and measures refracted light to approximate your blood pressure. However, this technology is still fairly new, and it's unclear how accurate it can be. While wearables are likely to get better over time, for the best accuracy, our testers say stick with the upper arm cuff devices that perform well in CR's tests. The benefits of vacuum sealing your food. Vacuum sealers are practical little machines that save you money by keeping your food fresher longer, especially if you like to buy in bulk and have plenty of freezer space. They work by extracting air from the bag and by fusing the sides together along a heated strip to create an airtight seal, something you'll appreciate if you've ever frozen an expensive piece of meat only to find it covered with a thin layer of ice crystals. That freezer burn doesn't render the meat unsafe, but it can change the meat's taste and texture. The vacuum bags are also perfect for sous vide cooking, in which food that's been sealed in a plastic bag gets dropped straight into the water to cook. Does vacuum sealing extend the storage life of food? Past CR's tests have shown the answer to be a resounding yes, says CR test engineer Bernie Dietrich. And our recent test of 7 models found that all rated excellent at sealing dry food, such as uncooked chicken, breast, or steak, but only very good or good at sealing moist food, think meat in a marinade. To help choose the right machine for your kitchen, consider size. Larger models such as Food Saver and Hamilton Beach models, shown here, as we'll talk about in a second, are bigger because they store a roll of plastic called a bag roll that you cut to size. Those without onboard bag roll storage, such as Ananofa and NutriChef below, are small enough to stash in a drawer. Prices for replacement rolls of bags vary. A batch of 44 quart-sized replacement bags for Food Saver models cost $21 on the brand's website, while 100 generic quart-sized bags cost $16 on Amazon. We tested 2 generic bags with all the sealers in our test, and they all work just fine. The ultimate food mailer is the Food Saver for $180. The great bang for your buck is the Ananova Color Culinary for $80. And small and speedy is the NutriChef PVK for $60. Turning the page. Deflate and fold your air mattress faster. Love camping but hate the frustration of trying to squash and crumple your air mattress back into the bag? Our pros show how to get it perfectly packed in 3 simple steps and offer tested models to take on your next adventure. Step 1. If your air mattress has a built-in reverse air pump, typically found on more expensive double-height mattresses, you can flip the switch to auto-deflate your bed. But with most single-height mattresses, you had to deflate it yourself by opening the plug and pushing the air out manually, starting at the opposite end. Once your mattress is deflated, fold the outer edges lengthwise, back and forth like an accordion, toward the middle. This action helps push out any air left inside the mattress. When you're done, the mattress should be smaller, skinnier, and rectangle. Go to the opposite end of the plug and roll towards the end with the plug, or fold it about a foot and a half inward at a time. Once you reach the other end, the mattress should be small enough to fit neatly back in its box for storage. We prefer models that come in a bag rather than a box, because bags are much easier to carry and repack. And here's the listing of a couple mattresses. Single-height air mattresses. The AeroBed and Coleman models below took 2 minutes to deflate in our test. The Intuk took 7 minutes, but cost much less. AeroBed Classic Inflatable for $125. The Coleman QuickBed Single High, $40. And Intel Classic Downy for $15. What grocery delivery services cost you? Ordering groceries online for home delivery can save you time and effort, but it can come at a high price. Some grocery services charge as much as $10 per delivery for delivery per order, and that can add up quickly. If you order frequently, a delivery subscription plan can help you pay less for convenience. But to see whether you actually save any money by signing up rather than paying for a delivery fee each time you order, you need to do a little math, as well as compare the different services that are available to you. First, figure out the delivery fee you pay each time you order without a subscription plan, and estimate how many times you typically order groceries in a given month. You also need to assess the amount of money you tend to spend on a single grocery order, because many services have a minimum order requirement of $35 or more. For instance, Instacart delivery fees are normally $3.99 per order without a subscription plan, but Instacart Express membership costs $99 per year, so you break even on the annual membership fee after 25 orders. Over a year of use, that means you need to order about twice a month or more to save money with an Instacart membership. If you tend to order less frequently than that, you're better off just paying the regular per-order delivery fees. To help you calculate the best delivery deal based on your own food shopping habits, we rounded up the typical fees for a few popular grocery delivery services and show you roughly how many times a year you'll need to order groceries before the subscription plan will start saving you money. Fresh Direct, the yearly fee is $129. Delivery fee per order without service, $5.99 to $7.99. Order needed to break even, $17 to $23. Minimum order of $30, no delivery fee on orders of $30 or more. Instacart Express, $99, $390 per fee, 25 orders needed to break even. Minimum order of $35, no delivery fee on orders of $35 or more. Shipt, every day, $99 yearly fee, $10 delivery, 10 orders to break even. No delivery fees on orders of $35 or more. If the order is less than $35, members pay $7 for delivery. Stop and Shop, Go Pass any day, $119 yearly fee, $6.95 per trip, $17 times to break even. Minimum order of $60, no delivery fees on orders of $100 or more. For orders that meet the minimum, $60, but are less than $100, GoPass members pay $3 for delivery. Stop and Shop, GoPass midweek, $55 annual fee, $6.95 inch delivery, eight deliveries need to break even. Same as above, but delivery must be on a Tuesday, Wednesday, or a Thursday. Walmart has a $98 annual fee, $9.95 per delivery, 10 deliveries to make it break even. Minimum order of $35, no delivery fee on orders of $35 or more. And let's do the time traveler, which is always interesting. In 1917, Ford Motor Company produces its first ever truck, known as the Model TT. It has a reinforced chassis and a rear axle, so it can haul up to 1 ton of weight in its truck bed. In 1946, Dodge makes the Power Wagon, a modified military truck with a 1 ton body and steel cab. We report it cost $500 more than its main competitor, the civilian Jeep. In 1948, the first Ford F-Series trucks, the predecessor of the popular Ford 150, hit the market with 8 models, from the half-ton capacity F1 to the 3-ton capacity F8. 1952, Volkswagen offers a unique-looking pickup truck version of its popular passenger van. In 1955, CR tests the Chevrolet Carryall, a station wagon built on a truck chassis. It fits 8 people, but we see it has a sloppy design and poor holding, and I'll testify to having driven one of those. In 1970, we put a 3,100-pound camper box in 4 popular pickups and find major safety concerns. All 4, a Chevy, a Dodge, a Ford, and an International, fail our braking tests. 1981, the Ford F-Series truck becomes the best-selling vehicle in the U.S. 1999, CR furnishes a guide to navigating common tuck towing scenarios from boats that weigh a few thousand pounds to a 7,000-pound Airstream trailer. 2007, CR tests 6 full-size cab crew pickups and recommends the Toyota Tundra SR5 TRD for its powerful, responsive powertrain and fantastic towing compatibility. In 2021, the Ridgeline earns the top spot in our compact truck ratings. At 20 miles per gallon overall, it's the most fuel-efficient truck that's not diesel or hybrid-powered. And the 2021 Honda Ridgeline goes from 36,490 to 43,920, and it's scored at 80 on their scale. The best way to make hot wings at home. There's no question that hot wings made in a deep fryer are delicious, but aside from being not so healthy, deep frying can be laborious and leaves you with a lot of oil to clean up. So CR staffers went on a quest to find the easier but still tasty way to make chicken wings at home. We tried 16 cooking techniques using a kitchen range, a gas grill, an air fryer, a multi-cooker, and a slow cooker. Then we betted the methods against each other in a tournament-style tasting test. We looked for golden brown, crispy skin on the outside with tender, juicy meat inside and sauce that stays on the skin, real deep fryer-like results. And if you broil it, You boil it low. You boil and broil with no rack. And well, actually, they ran a test. Anyway, the broil, the roast, the small appliances, and the grill. The winner was the air fryer. It came out the best. Air-fried wings. As you can see, air frying came out on top. It's the next best thing to deep-fried wings, says CR staff and cook Perry Santoche. Air fryers circulate hot air in the same way that convection ovens do, but they allow for more even, faster browning. To make our wings, we set the air fryer at 400 degrees for 20 minutes, then went and tossed them in a hot sauce in a bowl. Want to give it a try? These air fryers all perform well and are cinched to clean. The top of the heap is the Gourmet GAF 686 Digital at $90, according to ADI. It's got super 5 for 5 on controls, 4 for 5 on noise, and 4 for 5 on cleaning. Large capacity is a new wave, 6-quart at $130, scored to 75. It's 5 for 5 on controls, 3 for 5 on nose, and 4 for 5 on cleaning. For small kitchens, the Ninja AF100, $89. Overall score, 5 for 5 on controls, 3 for 5 on nose, and 4 for 5 for cleaning. Boiled then broiled wings on a sheet pan, the runner-up recipe. Don't have space for yet another countertop appliance? Our second favorite recipe requires the use of only your range. First, preheat the oven to 450 degrees Fahrenheit, the equivalent of a low broil. Then boil a pot of salty water, like you're cooking pasta. Add the wings to the pot and reduce the heat slightly, letting the pot simmer for 7 minutes. Drain the wings and let them dry well on a paper towel before placing them directly on a metal sheet pan. Line the pan with foil first for easy cleanup. With the skin side down, put the wings in the oven for 25 minutes. Then flip them and return them to the oven for 5 to 10 minutes more until the skin is golden and crisp. To finish, toss the wings in butter and your favorite hot sauce until evenly coated. That sounds good. How to find a big screen TV on a budget. Looking for a big screen that won't break the bank? It can be difficult to find one that offers the picture quality and overall experience we want without costing over $100,000. Yeah, right, Jim. $1,000. An analyst of more than 3 years of CR's TV ratings from March 1, 2018 to March 1, 2021 revealed that a very low price, for example, 65-inch set priced at around $450, often doesn't turn out to be a good deal because of poor performance and quality. In fact, our statisticians have noticed that as the average price of TVs drops, so does the average brand rating. A number of the most expensive TVs, from LG, Samsung, and Sony, earned top ratings in our test, and the lowest price sets, such as some we've tested from RCA, earned the lowest ratings. But there's good news. You can still find an affordable big-screen TV that rates well if you look in the right places. Start your search by checking our ratings for those brands that offer set prices of $1,000 or slightly lower, but on average still get very good ratings for our test. For example, CR's testing shows that models from somewhat newer low-cost brands, most notably TCL and Hisense, have been improving in picture quality recently, particularly in their upper-tier models, such as TLC's TCL 65-inch 6 series, which offers a lot of bang for your buck. Keep in mind that, according to our testers, performance can vary by model within a brand, so it's still crucial to research the specific model you're interested in. For example, some of TCL's 4 and 5 series sets, priced under $700, earn significantly lower ratings than TLC's 65R635, between $950 and $1,100, so they don't offer the same value. Sweet budget friendly file is a TLC 6R635. And it shows the quality between the Sony, LG, and Samsung. This is 65 inches, ranging price from $1,776 to $1,400. Under $1,000, the TCL gets $960. The Vizio gets 913, and those are all fairly good quality, 61 scores. But the Hisense and the RCA all fall off drastically. The personal info Instagram collects and how to limit it. Instagram, the social media app owned by Facebook, is great for sharing photos, but you may not realize that the app is collecting more data from you than just your smartphone's camera roll. In fact, Instagram may be gathering private contact info from your phone's address book and text messages log, as well as tracking your physical location. If you want to continue to use Instagram but also limit the information it collects from you, there are settings you can change if you know where to look. Here, the private intel you may already be sharing and how to put an end to that. Your phone contacts. When you first signed up for Instagram, you may have granted access to your phone's contact list. call log, and SMS text message history. Instagram says it uses this information to improve its products, but the details of what the company does with your data are unclear. One report from researchers at Princeton and Northeast University suggested that Facebook gleaned information from users' address books in order to talk with their friends with personalized advertising. Take action. On the Instagram app, go to your own profile, open the menu on the top right, Settings, Account, Contact, Syncing, switch the toggle off, and then, on a computer browser, log into Instagram, click on your profile picture in the top right to open the menu, Settings, Manage Contact, and delete all. Your precise location. Instagram can track your device location even when you're not using the app, and it can use that data to tailor ads to you on Instagram and on your Facebook profile. If you don't want marketers to pinpoint your whereabouts, turn off Instagram's access to your device's GPS. Know that doing so will stop Instagram from automatically suggesting location tags when you post, but you can always manually enter a location tag instead. Take action. On an iPhone, go to the phone setting, Privacy, Location Services, Instagram, then select Never. On an Android phone, go to the phone settings, Locations, App Permissions to Location, Instagram, then select Deny. Your online status. You may not realize that other Instagram users can see when you have an Instagram app open on your phone, even if you're not currently using the app when you last used it. For example, Instagram can tell other users you were active 2 minutes ago and that you're currently online, though your friends may find it handy to know when you're online to message you. You may not want to broadcast your activity every time you open the app. Note that if you turn off your activity status, you won't be able to see anyone else's activity either. Take action. On the Instagram app, go to your profile by clicking the icon in the bottom right, open the menu in the top right, Settings, Privacy, Activity Status, switch the toggle to App. July is the best time to buy sunscreen, washing machines, home security cameras, and dehumidifiers. Good news about battery-powered lawn tools. Every year we test more battery-operated tools, and every year we find newer reasons to recommend buying gas tools, says Misha Kolontai, CR's lead engineer for outdoor power equipment. Breakthroughs in battery capacity, along with improved efficiency in motors, have allowed even large power-hungry tools to go electric, and now some perform as well as or even better than gas models. If you're in need of new lawn tools this summer, here are three compelling reasons to opt for electric over gas, plus some of the best battery and gas lawns we'll test. Great performance. For the first time in CR's lawnmower test, the best battery-powered mowers we evaluated easily rival the best gas one, and several battery push mowers were tested, offering an impressive runtime of 70 to 80 minutes. That's enough to cut nearly half an acre in one charge, says Kolontai. And though battery-powered operated power tools sometimes cost more initially, if you purchase multiple tools from the same manufacturer platform, perhaps a lawnmower, string trimmer, and chainsaw, you can use one battery interchangeably in all of them, and for each tool you purchase without a battery, you save around 30%. Improved reliability. Based on CR member surveys, we've seen that in general, battery string trimmers and leaf blowers turn out to be less problematic over time than gas ones. For instance, all of the battery string trimmer brands we earn a rating of very good or excellent for predicted reliability, while less than half of the straight shaft gas brands that we rate in our survey score the same, and five gas brands earn only a fair rating. We see more variability with battery lawnmower brands, but a majority earn a reliability of good or better, and a handful of ratings of very good or excellent, roughly equivalent of reliability rating for gas mower brands. Long warranties. Many brands now offering lengthy warranties of 2 or 3 years on the battery itself, rather than 1 year, which was common on battery lawn tools just a few years ago. For example, the brand Ego offers a 3-year warranty on its battery and a 5-year warranty on the tool itself, a fairly common practice among battery tool makers. So when a problem arises with a battery-powered lawn tool, it may be easier to have it fixed than throw it out. That's good news for your wallet and for the planet. Plus, you won't have some of the added maintenance gas tool needs, such as stabilizing the fuel each winter. Your top-rated battery string trimmer is the Ego at $180. The top-rated gas spring trimmer is the Still FS 56 at $240. The top-rated battery-powered push mower is the Robi at $480. And the top-rated gas push mower is the Honda 400 at $400. I'm sorry, the Honda HRN at $400. And let's do two recalls here. Peloton Tread and Peloton Tread treadmills. Peloton recalled about 126,000 Peloton Tread and Peloton Tread treadmills, citing safety standards. The Peloton Tread Plus has linked a dozen of injuries to children, including one death. A May 2021 recall notice states that Peloton has received 70 reports of adult users, children, pets, owner objects being pulled under the rear of the treadmill, including 29 reports of injuries to children, such as second and third degree abrasions, broken bones, and lacerations. The company also recalled its new Peloton Tread because the touchscreen could detach and fall, posing a risk of injury to consumers. The Peloton Tread was available at onepeloton.com and Peloton showrooms from September 2018 through April 2021 for about $4,300. You used to be able to buy a car for that. The Peloton Tread was available via limited invitation only, release at onepeloton.com and at Peloton showrooms from November 2020 through March 2021 for about $2,500. Consumers should immediately stop using the treadmills and call Peloton at 866-679-9129 or go to onepeloton.com for a full refund. For consumers who do not want a refund, Peloton is offering to move the Tread treadmill free of charge to a room where children or pets cannot access the treadmill. The company is also implementing software improvements to the product that will automatically lock the tread after each use and prevent authorized access. A four-digit passcode will be required to unlock the Tread Plus. Peloton is also offering the option of waiting for a free inspection and repair that will secure the Peloton Tread touch screen to the treadmill to help prevent further incidences. And on a lighter note, let's close out with a me before coffee. Ugh, why is everyone shouting? Me after coffee. Okay, yes, I do see the fire now. My husband walked into the room and said, "How's my sleeping beauty?" I smiled and opened my eyes just in time to see him pat my sleeping puppy's head. After a visit to Yellowstone's Old Faithful, our family stopped at a gas station outside of the park. Our daughter leaned over the water mountain, and just as she was about to take a sip, the water shot up and sprayed her in the face. The gas station attendant smiled and said, "That's why we call it Old Faithful." Rummaging through my elderly mother's freezer, I found a pierogi and offered to cook them for her. "No," she said, "your sister made them, and I don't like pierogies." "Did you tell her that?" "Of course not," she said, scoffing at the very idea. "If I did, she wouldn't bring them anymore." And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.